Cheryl, he doesn't want to use my
hand right now. I might do this. I'm real bad at that.
I don't know what page you're on, but I'm just guessing.
We're on, it should be about page 7.
Well, you didn't push the wrong button on your printer like your brother did?
I hope not. Okay, so last week we left off on H, the effects of Satan's fall on the human race. We covered part of that, but we didn't get through it because we ran out of time. But we did see that Satan does oppress. He did oppress during the Lord's earthly ministry. He oppressed with physical ailments, and so the Lord Jesus, he healed many who were sick and various kinds of diseases. But they were oppressed by the devil, it says, and that's in Acts chapter 10 and verse 38. We also noted the effects of Satan's fall upon the unsaved. And in Matthew chapter 13 and verse 19 and Mark 4:15 and Luke 8:12, it describes how Satan snatched the word of God from their hearts. And that's something in the mystery form of the kingdom of God that it will, or the kingdom of the heavens, that it would take place. And in the, well, that's where we'll leave it. Today he blinds their minds to the gospel concerning Christ, and we've noted that. We'll be back to look at that again in 2 Corinthians 4 verses 3 and 4. And then he uses unbelievers to oppose true Christianity. And in Acts 16, we notice that the girl with the spirit of divination, the spirit of Python, it says in the Greek that she was opposing Paul and Silas in their ministry in Philippi. And remember, if you look at it, it says that the demon speaking through here was following Paul and Silas about, saying that they preach about a way of salvation, a quality of a way of salvation. Now, the King James and most translations probably put a definite article in there before it to say that they were preaching the way of salvation. But no, Satan used this girl through a demon. The demon worked through the girl to say that they were preaching a way, a quality of a way. And so it was one of many ways. And that's what's, and Satan will do that to try to mess people up. And so they say there would be more than one way. And so that was where we left off last week. So we're down to D. And if you will, let's go to Ephesians chapter 2. And in Ephesians 2, we'll look at verse 2. We're going to be back in this context, or around this context, but we have a couple of verses we want to look at here. And Paul is describing the condition of the Ephesian believers before their salvation. This was the condition that we were in too, before our salvation. And you don't really need the "hath he quickened" in the verse, as the AV says it, but it just says, "and you who were dead," and you being dead in trespasses and sins, this is where you were. This was your condition. You were spiritually dead in trespasses and sins. Wherein, in time past, and he goes back there to those things, you used to walk. He says you walked. And so in the past, they walked, they ordered their lives according to the standard of the course of this world. Now, the word "course" there is actually the word "age." And I don't know if any translations, I don't usually check out other translations to see if they change it. Does anybody have anything different? I don't know if it does change it or not.
It doesn't.
And so it should read, though the age of this world, the age that belongs to this world system. Now the age that we see here would be the present evil age of Galatians chapter 1 and verse 4. And so it's an evil age, but it's the age that pertains or belongs to this world system. And it's also measured by the prince, or according to, or measured by the standard of the prince of the authority of the air. It says power, and this word for power here is the word for authority. And so it's not the dunamis kind of power, the way I would translate power, but this is the word exousia that looks at authority, that kind of power. And so this is the prince of the authority of the air. And this is the spirit that now worketh or energizes, we could say. He energizes in the sons of disobedience. And so he does energize in his sons, though. And so they get their energy there. I want to draw a contrast here while I'm here. And when I think of this, I always go over to chapter 2 of Philippians. And in Philippians chapter 2, I want to just point something out, that we have a different source of energy. This was where we were in time past, though, before salvation. The prince of the power of the air, the authority of the air, Satan, he's the one who worked and energized in us before we were saved. And so he says that's where these Ephesians were at some time. This is where they used to be, but they're not anymore. And so we're not going to go that far down in the context, but I'll point it out. When you get down to verse 4 and move on down below verse 4, you have, but God who is rich in mercy. But this is, things changed because God intervened. But this is where we were. Now in Philippians chapter 2 and verse 13, after he tells you to work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, he doesn't say work it out to get it. He's saying you have salvation, you work it out now. You work it out. You live it. You work it. You work it. You work the salvation that you have. You are saved. And so you work it out. You can't work it out, but you do it with fear. You don't want to displease God. And you also do it with fear and trembling, he says. You don't want to be displeasing to God, though, would be the notion here. But he says in verse 13, for it is God. For God is the one, when it says, which worketh in you, he's the one energizing in you. It's the same, it comes from the same verb, and it's a participle here. He's the one energizing in you. So God is the one who energizes within us now, both to be willing and to be doing of his good pleasure. And to be energetic or to be doing of his good pleasure, though. And so God is the one who's energizing within us. Now, in our past condition, and for the unsaved, Satan does energize. He energizes his own. And so they get their energy, the way they operate. The one who enables them to operate is Satan, the prince of the authority of the air. And so he does energize within them, and they will do his will as he does energize in them. Now we'll be back. Well, we want to go on down and notice that he does, his will is involved, but I want to go on down to the third verse, and that is the next point, among whom also we all had our conversation. And now remember, this word conversation, this is not just a talk. It's not like we think of conversation, but it dealt with somebody's lifestyle. And so we all had our lifestyle. This is the way we were. It's different than walking, different term than walking. Walking is how you live, how you order your life, but this looks at the lifestyle that you live. And we all had our lifestyle in times past in the lust, the strong desires from our flesh. Fulfilling or doing the desires and of the flesh and of the mind, and were, and when it says the desires here, this is looking at the desirous wills of the flesh and of them and of the thoughts, I would say, instead of mind here, and were by nature the born ones of wrath, even as others, just as the rest of them, he says. And so this is what we were at one time. And so this is a description, but you notice Satan in here, he is the one who energizes, and yet in the next verse there, you do have your connection to the flesh. Interestingly enough, when you look at verses 2 and 3, of Ephesians 2, you do find all three of our enemies in there. You have the world system, you do have Satan, the prince of the authority of the air, and you also have have the flesh. And so there you have all three of them in the context there. Now I do want to go back to the other reference in John chapter 8, and this does bring in Satan's desirous will. And he has his wishes, just as God has a desirous will. Satan, he said he would be like the Most High God, but he also does have wishes, a thelema, and he does have a will for sure. So that's in John chapter 8, verse 44. And as we come back to this context, the Lord Jesus is having a discussion. It's more of a dispute with the Jews because there were those who didn't believe into him. And so they're giving him a lot of trouble. And so as he comes down, they've questioned his birth. In the context, but we won't go back to that. But as you come to verse 44, he says, you're out from your father, the devil. And so as to their source, I translate it out from, because it's a little preposition ek that means out from. And so they're looking at the source here. And so he says, you are out from your father, the devil, and the lusts. Now this is the word for strong desires, epithumia. And so this is strong desires, the strong desires belonging to your father. You, and now he turns to the verbal form, you are desirously willing to do. And so they want to do the things that the strong desires of their father. He has strong desires, though. He has lusts. But they want to do them with fellow. And so you have a contrast. His are strong desires, and they want to do his strong desires, his lusts. And so it goes on, and so that's about as far as I need to go at this point, just to point out that he does have lusts, and they want to do them. And so they're involved with his strong desires. And he's the one who energizes in them, and so they can do his strong desires, the thing that Satan really, really strongly desires for them. Now, we want to go back to 1 John chapter 5, and we see something else that Satan does with those who are his own, and he has his own. So we'll see in 1 John chapter 5 and verse 19, he uses a little word that it has to the idea of lying down, to recline, but it can, and in this context, it also has the idea to kind of rock a baby to sleep, and it is used in that sense. But let's look at 5:19. Now we'll be back to verse 18 because you find that. The malignant evil one, the wicked one, toucheth him not. He can't touch you. But notice verse 19, and we know, and he says, we know this factually, we know this with a head knowledge, that we are out from God. And so he said, uses the word oida here. We know that we are out from God as to our source and the whole world. Now, when he speaks of the world here, a world, you have to determine how world is used by the context. And sometimes the world is just used of the vast system. But when it's used in a non-technical way, it could be just used of an orderly system. And sometimes it's used of the universe in that way, in some context where it's not used in an ethical sense. But here it's used of mankind. It's not the world system itself, but the whole world of mankind. It lieth, it says, in wickedness. No, the word wickedness here, just we could translate it lieth in the wicked one. And so it's lying in the wicked one, not wickedness. And the one who's the wicked one is Satan. He is the malignant evil one. And so it lieth in this one who is malignantly evil. Now the word lieth here has the idea, if you take, and this is where it has the idea, as I put it in your notes, that he rocks them to sleep. And that's the idea. It lieth in the wicked one. And so it's like it's lying in his lap. And he's just kind of rocking this little baby to sleep, so to speak. And he does that in self-satisfaction and complacency where they are. They're satisfied where they are. And he just kind of just lulls them to sleep there, rocking them along as they lieth in the malignant evil one. And so Satan has a real authority with these, and they don't mind it. They're just kind of like his baby, and it's kind of like we're going to see that they are out from. We saw they are out from their father, the devil, but they're his born ones. Now, when we move on, we want to consider the effects of Satan's fall upon saved people. Now, these are the things how Satan affects the unsaved. But now we want to see the effects of Satan's fall upon saved people, since he is a fallen creature. Now, he sows tares among them, and we'll go back to Matthew 13 to some of the parables. And in Matthew 13, we come to the parables of the mystery form of the kingdom of the heavens. And we'll be looking at verses 25 through 40, but we won't go through all of those verses for time's sake. But I will pick up part of the parable, and you see that it's a parable in verse 24. And he gives a series of parables, and the Lord does interpret some of them. And so he is going to interpret this one, so we'll know exactly what he meant. And so it's not left to our imagination. And when he didn't interpret them, you still come to the pattern here as to what he meant by what he had to say. And so in Matthew 13, and as we look at verse 24, he says, "Another parable put he forth unto them." So he's just given some parables, but he gives another one of the same kind, he says.
The kingdom there is the millennial kingdom?
Yeah, that's where, it's anticipating.
Oh,
yeah. But this is the mystery form of the kingdom,
yeah. Okay.
As it goes on. And so but it does involve, it has a sphere of profession, as well as those who you could have those who are saved and unsaved within this kingdom, as you see it. But when you see this, now he says, "The kingdom of the heavens is likened unto a man which sowed good seed in his field." Now, we'll just go through the parable as he gives it. "And while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat." Now, the tares, it's a darnel is what it was, but it was a weed, and it was very. It looked just like the wheat as it was growing up, and so they sprang up together. It was hard to tell a difference, and then they would be intertwined and so forth, the roots would. And so, but they were sowed. And really he oversowed tares among the wheat and went his way. "And when the blade was sprung up and brought forth fruit, it then appeared the tares also. So the servants of the householder came and said unto him, 'Sir, didst not thou sow good seed in thy field? From whence then hath it tares?' And he said unto them, 'An enemy hath done this.' The servant said unto him, 'Wilt thou then that we go and gather them up?' And he said, 'No, lest while you gather up the tares, you root up also the wheat with them. Let them both grow together and, until the harvest. And in time of harvest, I will say unto the reapers, gather ye together first the tares, and bind them in bundles and burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn.'" Now, you would be left to your imagination to figure out what he was saying, if he didn't tell us what. And the disciples didn't know what he was saying, what he meant. Now, if the Lord did say on occasion in the Gospels when he gave parables that he spoke them not to make anything clear, but he did it to hide truth. And he was hiding the truth. Actually, he was hiding the truth from those who didn't believe. And so he does give you the interpretation of it. And so these are the verses that we'll pick up down in verse 36. And so you see, Okay. But we find that when the Lord was speaking these things in verses 34 and 35, he spoke in parables to them. And he does it so that they really so they won't understand. And he does say that elsewhere. I won't pick it up right now because I hadn't planned to go there. Wasn't looking at the parable, but it'd take a moment to pick it up. But then Jesus, in verse 36, so then Jesus sent the multitude away and went into the house. And his disciples came unto him, saying, declare unto us the parable of the tares of the field. And so they didn't understand it either. And he answered and said unto them, he that soweth the good seed is who? The Son of Man. So he is the one who sows the good seed. And so as he sows the good seed, he says the field is the world. And so the world of mankind, and so this is the world, and the good seed are the sons, not the children, but the sons of the kingdom. But the tares are the sons of the malignant evil one. And so you have the Son of Man, he sows a good seed, and then you have a bad seed. You have the tares. And so the good seed, though, are sons of the kingdom, and then you have the sons of the malignant evil one. And the wicked one is just the word Poneros, the malignant evil one. The enemy that sowed them, now here we come to our subject, and that is the devil. And so the devil sowed the tares. He's the one who comes in and oversows tares. And so he puts those in amongst the good seed, the sons of the kingdom. He slips in some who are his sons. And so he slips his sons in. And when it speaks of sons, they are his mature sons. And so then the harvest is the end, not of the world, but the end of the age. And I imagine that the New King James and the New American Standard and some others probably changed that to age. They should. But this would be the end of the legal age. And the reapers, who are the reapers who are going to come and harvest? They're the angels. As therefore the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so shall it be in the end of this age. And so the word world there again should be age. And so this, and notice, well, verse 41, we'll finish this off. The Son of Man shall send forth his angels, and they shall gather out of his kingdom. And so this is the kingdom of the heavens now. All things that scandalize. The word offend here, we'll just transliterate it as scandalize. And them which do lawlessly. And so it's the word iniquity doesn't really mean anything in English. It translates too many different Greek words, and in the Old Testament too many Hebrew words. And so it really is just kind of doesn't mean much of anything. But it is the word for lawlessness here, or for being lawless.
Dale, I just want okay. The Son of Man that's up on verse 37.
Yeah.
That's talking about Christ?
That's about Christ. He's okay. The Son of Man. And he always, you only find he's referred to as the Son of Man in the Gospels, as the Son of Man in his relationship to Israel as a Jew. He was born a Jew, and he has that relationship to man, and it's used in that kind of a context, as it emphasizes him as the Son of Man, though. And so he's the one who will send forth his angels, and he's going to deal with those, he's going to take those out of the kingdom who don't belong there, and who've been oversown, whom Satan has snuck into the kingdom. And then shall cast them into the furnace of fire, and there shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth. And then shall the righteous shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Here's a place you can see that after the kingdom of the heavens, the Father's kingdom will come. That's something that I refer to this verse anyway in my paper tomorrow, because it deals with dealing with the Lord's Prayer. I'm not spending much time on the Lord's Prayer, but when the prayer was, "Thy kingdom come, Thy will be done," it's not Christ's kingdom there. It's Thy kingdom. Whose kingdom? He's addressing the Father. They're to address the Father. They're looking for the Father's kingdom, which will come after the kingdom of the heavens, after Christ's millennial reign. when he establishes his kingdom. After that, the Father's kingdom will come. But here you see those who come out of who are left to come out of his kingdom, they'll shine forth as S-U-N. They're going to have a garment of light, we could say, in the kingdom of their Father. And their Father, that is God the Father's kingdom. And so not the kingdom of the heavens now. So this is the kingdom that will follow the kingdom of the heavens. And so anyway, he interprets it. And so we end up spending quite a bit of time there. But what does Satan do? He oversows. He puts tares into the kingdom. And so that's looking at the kingdom. And it is dealing with in that specific context. Now, another thing that Satan does, and in effect, you could say that in the world of professing Christendom, this would relate to some of that, where he oversows, and then you have unbelievers mixed in who are going to be dealt with. But this is looking forward at the end of the parable here. It's looking forward to the millennial kingdom. Now, back in Revelation 12, we'll move back there. We've looked at Satan there and the descriptions of him as he's described in these various ways by the various titles. We see that he's the great dragon in verse 9. Saw him as the red dragon in verse 3, but he is the great dragon, verse 9, he's the old serpent, and that connects him back to the Garden of Eden, where the serpent spoke to Eve, and he's also called the devil and Satan. And so these are his names, but we find in this context also what he does there in verse 9. And so we'll just go ahead and read it. I kind of halfway skimmed through it, but anyway, and the great dragon was cast out that old serpent called the devil and Satan. Notice what he does, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. And so this is an anticipation of his being cast out of heaven. But he is a deceiver. But notice verse 10, and this is how it affects saved people. And this will affect, in this context, it's dealing more so with the tribulation saints, I believe, but it still describes what he does. Now, Satan has not been cast out of heaven yet. And so the Lord saw him coming and prophetically in the Gospels. But if you remember back in Job, if you weren't here, some of you, but in Job chapters 1 and 2, Satan went before God and he did this in a day when the sons of God came before God. And so he with other spirit beings came in before God, and he did. One thing he did, he says, "Do you ever consider Job?" And so he does bring. So he does. He was accusing a pre-Old Testament saint before the law was given, and so he did come and he brought some. Oh, you're just protecting Job. You put a hedge around him. You do this to him, and he'll curse you. But no, Job was as God knew Job's heart. But as we go on to verse 10 here, but Satan did have access to the throne, and he still does this here. We see, and I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, "Now is come to be salvation," and it says strength, it's dunamis, it's inherent power, "and the kingdom of our God, and the authority," the word power here is exousia, authority, "of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren," notice, "the accuser of our brethren is cast down." And so this is anticipating when he will be cast out, "which accused them," notice how often he accused them before our God day and night. And so there was a continuous thing. He was accusing the brethren. And there's no question about it that he accuses, he's the accuser. And so there's little doubt that he doesn't accuse when we do something too. When we sin, Satan will be right there to jump on it, I'm sure. But the Father just has to look over to the Son and say, "It's taken care of. It's done." And so there's nothing he has nothing more to say about it. But he is the accuser of the brethren. He also will bring persecution about to believers, and that's in Revelation chapter 2. Revelation chapter 2 and verse 10. And this is dealing with the church in Smyrna. And this was a church, the word Smyrna comes from myrrh. And this church suffered persecution. And they, so it was like they were crushed and gave off an aroma, so to speak. But they, and most of this church ended up dying. But we won't go back into the context, but it deals with that. And I will go back to verse 9. I know thy works and tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich. And I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. And so there were some in Smyrna who were believers, but there were others there who were not. They professed to be Jews, but they really belonged to the synagogue of Satan. Satan had his synagogue there amongst these believers. And so but then verse 10 is what I want to look at. Fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison, that ye may be tried. And the word tried here, you're going to be put to the test. It's like you're going to be thrown into the furnace to see if he can bring out something bad. It's pyrazo, which has the idea to put to the test to solicit you to evil. It's to bring about the bad, to bring out, not to bring out the good. That would be a docimazo, a different term. But this is to put you to the test, to bring out, to solicit you to evil. And ye shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. And that would be a crown. And this is one of the things that a Christian can win. You can win a crown by the life that they live, by overcoming the temptation, we could say. But they will win a crown of life. And we'll let it go. But you can see there that there would be persecution. Now Satan himself is not going to personally come and put them in prison, but he will manipulate so that they end up in prison, and they will be put to the test in that sense. Now he hinders believers also in their work, and so we'll go back to 1 Thessalonians 2. 1 Thessalonians 2 and verse 18 describes something else Satan can do with believers. And this is when Paul was hindered by Satan. He really wanted to come and see them, but Satan hindered him along with Silas and Timothy. And so 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 18. We'll pick up in verse 17. But we, brethren, being taken from you for a short time in presence, not in heart, endeavored the more abundantly to see your face with great desire. And so Paul left, but he really wanted to go back. But he says, wherefore we would have come unto you, even I, Paul, once and again. But Satan hindered us. And so he did run into some opposition, and Satan brought up opposition. So when Paul, when Paul left Thessalonica, he wasn't able to return. He fled on down and ended up down in Corinth. And he spent about 18 months down there. He was in Athens and then in Corinth, and he spent a lot of time down in Greece. And so he never made it back up to up to Thessalonica. But Satan hindered him, and some of the events that kept him from returning was the work of Satan. Now, he uses demons also to attack believers to cause them to fail in their Christian lives. And so Satan himself isn't omnipresent. He isn't everywhere. But let's go to Ephesians chapter 6. And Satan does use his armies, And we saw his armies back in Revelation chapter 12 and verse 9, verse 7 and 8 and 9. But he had his armies, his heavenly armies. And so that his armies, his host, who also he uses. And so Satan can't be everywhere. Sometimes it may be a personal attack from Satan, but oftentimes he'll use a demon to bring a temptation to us also, to put a lust before us. And so in Ephesians 6:11, when we come back to the defenses against Satan, we will notice how it relates to our position in Christ in verse 10. You have to be inherently powerful in the Lord. And it's the word for power and endowment of power in the Lord, and in the, and I would translate it, the might that comes out from his strength. And so you need to be strong, be inherently powerful, though inherently strong. And so that before you put on the armor, but it's in the Lord, you'll notice, in the Lord. And so it's not something we can defend against Satan on our own. But notice we're looking at actually at his use of his spirit beings, the angels who fell with him. And so in verse 11 he says, "Put on the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil." The wiles just looks at his craft, his methods. We get our word methods from this word. And so that we may be able to stand against his methods. And his methods are crafty. He's a very, very, very cunning, very crafty. And we noticed that back in Genesis when we were considering his temptation back there. He was the most subtle of the beasts of the field, the serpent was. But the serpent was represented, Satan was ministered, working through the serpent. And we see he was the old serpent in Revelation 12:9. But he was the most cunning, the most crafty. And so we can. The only way we can stand is by putting on the armor, though, and then we can stand against his methods. For, he says in verse 12, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. So this isn't a physical wrestling match, obviously, and Paul wants to spell that out very clearly here. And Paul was familiar. He was familiar with boxing and wrestling and running and everything. He uses quite a bit of that imagery. He must have had some interest in it, but he said, "This is not what we wrestle against flesh and blood." He's not against humans, but against principalities, against authorities. The word powers here is authorities, against the rulers of the darkness of this age. It shouldn't read world there, it should read age. Against spiritual wickedness or wicked spirits in the heavenlies. It shouldn't read heavenly places. They supplied places there in high places. It should just read in the heavenlies. And so it's funny, they didn't translate it on high elsewhere, but they did it here, I guess because of the fact that there were fallen spirit beings there. And when he speaks of principalities, these who are rulers, these are spirit beings against rulers and all of the principalities and powers. These are lower ranks of spirit beings. We won't go there now. We'll be back. But in Colossians chapter 1, you do see some of that in 1:16, where the Son was involved with the creation of the various spirit angelic beings, we'll say. Then these are the lower ranks. And so Satan drew a third of the stars of the heaven back in Revelation 12:3, and these would be from the lower ranks, and these were his minions that function and enable him. And so when our struggle in our Christian life, when it comes to Satan, he does use his demons, and so it is a wrestling match with spirit beings, so to speak, but it's a spiritual wrestling match. And so they can come and put thoughts in your mind, bring circumstances into your way and such. They can do various things. Paul was very well aware of how Satan himself had opposed him and put opposition before him so that he couldn't carry on what he thought he would like to do and in his ministry and such in Thessalonica. But we could see a lot of how Satan could influence and did some influence upon people. Now, he does that. Now, I do want to go back again under that same point, back to 2 Corinthians 12. 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 7. 2 Corinthians 12, 7 does deal with Satan's use of his being, his forces again. And we see here that Satan has a messenger. And this is in the context, if you recall, Satan, this is when Paul had a thorn in the flesh, and that's what he's going to tell us in verse 7. And this would take us back to Acts 14 when he was stoned at Lystra, and he was caught up to the edge of the third heaven. It tells us at the beginning of chapter 12, but he was caught up into paradise. He didn't go all the way into the third heaven, but up to the edge of the third heaven. So we know there are three heavens. He was caught right up to the edge, and that was to where paradise had been removed from the heart of the earth, right up to the edge of the third heaven. But he was caught up there, and he received just so he couldn't boast, he saw some things that you couldn't talk about as a man. He saw some visions and things. He saw some things that it was something he couldn't speak about. And so he says, "Unless I should be exalted," in verse 7, "above measure through the abundance of the revelations, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh." Now notice what this thorn in the flesh, he describes it, the messenger from Satan to buffet me. And so this idea of buffeting, this would be like a pugilist kind of a term. It'd be like striking him in the face, to strike him to strike him under the eye, kind of to strike him in the face, though, to buffet me. And so this was a painful thing that Paul had, and it was a painful injury. It was something that he carried with him then for the rest of his life, as far as we know. But he said, "Lest I should be exalted above measure." And so he carried something with him that was painful, a thorn. And so a thorn is painful. And it can be a small thing or it can be a big thing, but it can be a painful thing no matter what. And so we've all had thorns, but this was an irritating, ongoing, painful thing that Paul endured. But it came about from a messenger from Satan. And so it was a messenger from Satan that came upon him and left this thorn. And so anyway, he asked the Lord that he might take it away three times. And the Lord said, "I always like this. My grace is sufficient. It's enough for you, Paul. You don't need anything else." He says, "For my strength is," and this is my power, actually, "my dunamis is made complete," perfect or complete, "in weakness. And so most gladly, therefore, will I rather boast in my weaknesses," and the word glory is boast, "that the inherent power of Christ may rest upon me," and it rests upon him like a tent. And so Paul's going to boast in all of these bad things that he's gone through and such. He doesn't mind being weak, because then Paul can't do it in Paul's strength. And if you stop and consider Paul was a guy who could really get things done. He was a man on the go, a man who was heading places. When he went out and persecuted the church, he was moving right up to the top there. He was a very important young Jewish fellow. And they say he probably would have been the next great Jewish rabbin, the great rabbi of the Jews. He was on his way, and he had been taught by one of the greatest teachers, and he was a very important fellow. Paul had a lot to boast about in the flesh, but he wasn't going to. But then when he was saved on the Damascus Road, what does he do? We find him now, he's now ministering, preaching Christ, the one that he was out persecuting, those who were believers. He was out persecuting them. Now he himself is going to become one who's persecuted. But anyway, Paul here realizes He saw some things when, and I believe he was stoned at Lystra. I believe it says that they took him in as dead. And when they stoned somebody, they crushed their head, they crushed their chest, they really crushed them. They knew how to kill. It wasn't just they killed him. And so they took him up for dead, and they took him into the city. And miraculously, the next day he left and walked for how many miles? Probably 30-some miles or something, a long ways anyway, after that. But that was as big a miracle. But he moved on and left Lystra at that time. But it was a thorn in the flesh, though, Satan. But it was a minister from Satan. It was a demon that was involved with that. Probably directed the stone that hit him, that left the painful situation that he had. And we won't go into what it was. There's a lot of speculation as to what the problem was, what the thorn in the flesh was. And if you looked at commentaries on it, the
eyesight.
Yeah, well, probably the closest thing would be eyesight, because he does speak of problems with his eyes. He does speak about that. That's probably the most legitimate, but most of them, it's everything they had. So the commentary.
It sounds a little different than what you were saying with a thorn, as far as it hurting, though.
It was a painful condition.
It was painful.
It was painful, and it was an ongoing thing, and something that you... If you have a good thorn, you don't. It just annoys you to no end.
Yeah.
And so, anyway, that was the kind of thing that he had. But he used. But again, it was a messenger from Satan. A messenger, so an angel from Satan who was the one who brought this to him. And so Satan does use demons to attack and cause Christians. This would have been something he would have brought about a failure in Paul's life, but it was reversed. Instead of bringing about failure, what happened? Paul learned that he couldn't do it himself. He had to depend on Christ, and that's when the power of Christ settled over him like a tent, so to speak. Yeah. And it wasn't Paul now doing it. It was the power of Christ and the power of the indwelling Christ working through him. But that was something Paul learned through this, and Satan was allowed to do that. And so sometimes God allows things in our lives and allows Satan to do things that would affect us in our Christian lives, but it's for us to grow and to mature and to be stronger and to realize we can't do it on ourselves and on our own. And that's something Paul learned.
Well, whereas, you know, Kathy and I are kind of going through this with Ethan now, you know.
Yeah.
On this. But the thing I was just thinking about is that the Spirit of God must have let him know that Satan was doing this.
Yeah.
I mean, because most of there might be things going on in your life you would never know that.
Yeah.
That is the case. That
and he knew where it came from.
He knew where it came from. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's no doubt that he knew where it came from, and the things that he saw and such, he knew that this was something God allowed into his life, but God had other purposes than Satan's. So Satan, the messenger, buffeted him. He struck him in the face, so to speak, not physically, but somebody else did. He probably directed the stone. As he did so, Paul learned he would like to have the thorn removed. Who wouldn't? But then, after three times, the Lord said, "My grace is enough. It's sufficient. It's enough." And so, anyway, that's that he can use demons. Now, Satan does have a relationship to mankind, and. Well, some of you won't be here next week, so and we only have a couple minutes and a half left to go. So I'll just kind of give you a quick survey of it. When the relationship of Satan to mankind, to the unsaved, he does have his own children, and so you are of your father the devil, John 8:44, and 1 John 3:8-10, it speaks of those who are habitually sin. He says if you habitually keep on doing sin, he says you are out from the devil. in 1 John 3:8-10. Satan has his mature sons. We noticed those in Ephesians 2:2, and over in 2 Thessalonians 2:9, the man of lawlessness is described in that sense. He's a son, a mature son. Elymas the sorcerer was another one in Acts 13:10, and so on. Now, one thing, we could go and look at it, and that would be with Judas Iscariot. In Luke 22:3, Satan entered into him. And in John 13:27, it says that after he dipped the morsel into the morsel, the Satan entered into him. And so Satan did enter into him. But also Satan can put things into the hearts of his own. And so in John 13:2, Satan had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot to betray the Lord. And so Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, he looked just like the rest of them, acted just like the rest of them. The rest of them couldn't tell the difference. In fact, they trusted him with the money bag. He was the treasurer, and yet he was a thief. We're told it turns out that he was a thief, but he handled the money, and yet Satan did enter into, put it into his heart. He was an unbeliever, one of the 12. He didn't look any different, and yet he did his deed, and God allowed that. Now Satan, we also noted that he deceives the world, and he blinds the workings of the mind. And in 2 Corinthians 4:3-4, since our gospel be hid, it is hid to them who are presently lost, and the ones who are perishing, and the one who is blinded their minds is the God of this age. And so Satan is the God of this age. His age has blinded their minds. But what has he blinded their minds to? He's blinded their minds to the gospel concerning the glory of Christ. And so the gospel for salvation, he has blinded the workings of their minds so that they can't get it through their thick skulls. They're blinded, and so they cannot see the gospel, and that's something that Satan does to the unsaved, and they are under his authority. And that's as far as I'll go, so we can get home and get some rest for tomorrow. But we'll pick up back at the beginning there. We'll make a note and pick up, and we'll go through those references next time, Lord willing, unless we're all caught up together to meet the Lord in air, which would be far much more better. And so we will be back here then, some of us. Okay. Father, we're grateful again for your provisions for us under grace, for your provision in each realm of our Christian lives, that you know what we need to grow and mature. You know what we can handle, and you have provided for us a way out when we do enter into temptation, but you've also provided the way to handle it, to deal with each of our enemies. And as we consider Satan, we're thankful that we do not belong to him, that we don't belong to him at all in any way any longer, but that we do belong to you as your sons, not as his children, but as your sons. And so we're thankful for that relationship we have with you, and that because of our relationship to you as sons, that you do deal with us as sons, and yet you care for us as sons, and you have provided every means that we need to have victory over our adversary, the devil. And so, again, might we avail ourselves of that, and as we continue our study of this, might we be well aware of your provisions for us under grace in dealing with this one, and we'd be grateful as we move into the evening, and might we have a restful evening, and might you, again, give safety to those who may be traveling to the forum tomorrow, and also might you give clarity of mind and focus and strength and rest in preparation for the forum, and just ask that it might be a time of blessing to each one, a time of edification, and a time that through it all that you might be glorified. to think of those who are not able to be there because of work, that you might give them strength and rest for their day tomorrow and the rest of the week too, and we'd be grateful for that. Amen.